Imagine the Supreme Court traveling like roughly 100 miles on foot over brutal mountainous terrain. And they do this entirely to pick a fight with a rural carpenter about his hand washing habits.
Yeah, it sounds completely absurd when you put it like that.
It really does. But when you open up the prep document for Matthew chapter 15, that exact scenario is what kicks off an absolute political earthquake.
It really is an earthquake.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We are so thrilled you are here with us. Because today, our mission is to tear into this ancient text and uncover how a seemingly localized religious dispute morphed into this high-stakes historical and political thriller.
Right, and it's full of escalating tension.
Exactly.
Okay,
Okay, let's
yeah.
unpack this, because if you look at the opening scene strictly as a quiet theological debate, you miss the actual danger.
You missed the whole point.
Right. This is a massive political crackdown. It's the equivalent of a supreme authority dispatching a top-level investigative committee from the capital city, way out to the distant provinces for one reason, to silence a massive growing threat.
And that framing changes everything about how you read this. We are looking at a pivotal turning point in first century history.
A major turning point.
Absolutely. This text captures the precise moment where the institutional legitimacy of the old guard begins to publicly decay. And, simultaneously, it's the moment where this new movement radically expands beyond its original cultural
That's
borders.
huge.
It is. The friction between those two realities is what generates all the historical drama we are about to explore.
To grasp the sheer friction of that moment, we really need to look at who is doing the challenging. The text specifically notes that the Pharisees and scribes came to Jesus from Jerusalem.
From Jerusalem, that is key.
Right. If you were listening to this and thinking, well, so some religious guy showed up to ask a few questions, you have to remember the geography. Jerusalem is the undisputed religious and political capital.
The center of power.
Exactly. And Galilee is way, way up north.
It is a significant, arduous journey. I mean, it would have taken days of really difficult travel.
Just walking through the dust and heat.
Yeah. They didn't just happen to be in the neighborhood catching a local teaching. This was an official, coordinated delegation.
A strike team,
Yes,
basically.
basically, yeah. And that geographic shift proves that Jesus was no longer just a minor regional nuisance to be handled by local synagogue
He was
leaders.
on the Capitol's radar.
Big time. His influence had grown so large and his crowds had become so massive that the Capitol had to send in the heavy hitters to assess and, frankly, eliminate the threat.
But this is what I struggle with when looking at the source. They hike all the way up to Galilee, find this massive political threat, and their opening salvo is hygiene.
It sounds like a joke.
It does. They accuse the disciples of eating with unwashed hands. Like, why would such a seemingly minor domestic issue trigger this massive confrontation?
It's a great question.
If this is a political thriller, why are they arguing about dirty fingers?
What's fascinating here is that the attack has absolutely nothing to do with biblical law, and it certainly has nothing to do with hygiene.
Right, because germ theory didn't exist yet.
Exactly. They didn't know about bacteria. The delegation is enforcing something called the tradition of the elders.
Okay, let's pause there. What exactly is that mechanism? Because the document makes a really clear distinction between the actual written law and this specific tradition.
Right, so the tradition of the elders was this elaborate extra-biblical system of oral rulings and rituals. And it was developed over a long period of time by the Pharisees.
So it wasn't in the original scriptures.
No, it operated completely outside of the actual scriptural commandments. The Pharisees used this elaborate system to maintain their institutional power and create severe social stratification.
Wow.
By controlling the minutiae of daily life, down to exactly how water is poured over the hands before a meal to achieve ritual purity, they set themselves up as the ultimate gatekeepers.
They get to decide who is in and who is out.
Precisely. They decided who was acceptable to God and who was an outcast.
So it operates almost like an invisible caste system. If you don't perform the ritual exactly as the experts dictate, you are socially and religiously marginalized.
You're shunned, essentially.
Right. So breaking the hand-washing rule isn't about dirt. It is an act of political defiance.
Yes. That is the perfect way to put it.
It shows the massive crowds that these capital city gatekeepers don't actually hold the authority they claim to possess.
Exactly. If the general population stops obeying the tradition of the elders, the Pharisees lose their grip on the society.
Because it's all built on compliance.
Right. Their entire power structure relies on the public buying into these extra rules. Without that compliance, their political and social leverage just evaporates.
Which makes Jesus' rebuttal hit so much harder.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't apologize, and he doesn't try to negotiate the finer points of ritual washing.
He goes straight for the jugular.
He really does. He pivots and accuses them of elevating their own human rules over divine law. He quotes the prophets in Matthew 15, verses 8 and 9, saying, "These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me."
A huge insult.
Massive. He says they worship me in vain. Their teachings are merely human rules. He is completely invalidating their regulatory authority in front of everyone.
He is publicly dismantling the legal foundation of their power.
It is like a corporate whistleblower bypassing the HR department, standing on a desk, and telling the entire company that the employee handbook itself is illegal.
That is a great analogy.
And then he turns to the crowd in verse 11 and delivers this absolute mic drop moment. He says, "What goes into someone's mouth does not defile them, but what comes out of their mouth, that is what defiles them."
Yeah.
He tells the people that true corruption comes from within the heart, effectively stripping the Pharisees of their entire system of control.
You have to imagine the reaction of that Jerusalem delegation. I mean, they marched all those miles to assert dominance.
Probably exhausted too.
Very. And instead, their entire premise of authority was dismantled in front of the very people they were trying to control.
But here is the causal link that really drives the narrative forward. Jesus didn't just insult them. He humiliated the top-ranking officials of his era, effectively severing their authority.
Which is incredibly dangerous.
Right. Doing that in Galilee makes him a massive target. Staying there to bask in the victory would essentially be a death sentence.
He had to move.
Yeah, he is forced into a tactical retreat. And that forces him to make a move that honestly is shocking. He leaves Jewish territory entirely and withdraws to the region of Tyre and Sidon.
The geographical shift here is arguably more important than the first one.
Really?
Yeah. Tyre and Sidon are located in modern-day southern Lebanon. This isn't just neutral ground.
It's actively hostile.
Very. Historically, as the text notes, the Tyrians harbored deep, entrenched animosity toward the Jewish people. This is an area defined by historical conflict and border disputes.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because if we look at this through our political thriller lens, this is wildly transgressive behavior.
Well, absolutely.
It is the equivalent of a major political leader abandoning their own capital to walk straight into enemy headquarters. It's the absolute last place anyone would expect him to go after picking a fight with the authorities back home.
And it is in this profoundly hostile territory that he has an encounter that defines the rest of the chapter.
The woman.
Right. He meets a desperate woman who is begging for her demon-possessed daughter to be healed. But the author doesn't just call her a woman. She is specifically identified as a Canaanite.
I want to dig into that term, Canaanite. For the listener who might just skim past that word, how heavy is that designation in this historical context?
It is immensely heavy. The Canaanites represent ancient Israel's blood enemies.
Like going way back.
Going all the way back to the ancient conquests of Canaan. These are the ancestral foes. She is the living embodiment of the ultimate outsider.
Wow.
To the Pharisees back in Jerusalem, she would be considered deeply, irredeemably impure. She is everything their tradition of the elders was designed to keep away.
Yet she approaches him. And she exhibits this profound, relentless faith. She actually debates with him, you know, using his own analogies, refusing to give up.
She pushes back.
She does. And the resolution in verse 28 completely shatters the established norms. Jesus says to her, "Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted, and her daughter is healed instantly."
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you have to ask why this specific encounter is placed immediately after the clash over hand washing.
Right. The juxtaposition is crazy.
It's intentional. The religious elites in Jerusalem were entirely focused on religious exclusivity, protecting the insiders, enforcing strict rituals, maintaining pure bloodlines.
Keeping the borders secure.
Exactly. But by engaging with this Canaanite woman, a literal blood enemy, and granting her request based entirely on her persistent faith, Jesus is proving that faith matters infinitely more than ancestral bloodlines.
He is replacing a system of biological and ritual exclusivity with a system of faith-based inclusivity. The rigid borders of the old establishment are suddenly obsolete.
Exactly. It forces the reader to realize that the kingdom he is building does not rely on the traditions the Pharisees were so desperate to protect.
And this radical acceptance of one outsider doesn't remain an isolated incident. it serves as the catalyst for a massive cultural shift.
It snowballs.
It really does. It scales up almost immediately into a mass movement in Gentile territory. Which brings us to the miracle of feeding the 4,000.
A huge moment.
Now, I have to admit, when I was reviewing the source document, I had a moment of confusion. I was thinking, wait, didn't we just read about him feeding 5,000 people a few chapters ago?
A lot of people wonder that.
Yeah, like, why is this second feeding specifically highlighted as a major political and cultural threat? It felt slightly repetitive.
It feels repetitive until you look at the underlying mechanisms of the text. The repetition is highly deliberate, but the context has completely flipped. Well, the feeding of the 5,000 happened in Jewish territory for a Jewish audience. This feeding of the 4,000 happens in Gentile territory. And the source points out a brilliant linguistic clue that essentially serves as a cultural timestamp for the reader.
Wait, hold on. You're telling me Matthew, the author, was essentially acting like a modern film director planting an Easter egg in the background of a shot?
Basically, yes.
He's using local props to signal a massive geopolitical shift to his readers.
That is exactly what he is doing. In the original Greek text, the specific word used for the baskets that collect the leftover food in this miracle of the 4,000 is distinctly different from the word used in the earlier miracle.
Okay, I love this kind of detail.
It's so cool. For the 5,000, the text uses the word kofinos, which were typical Jewish wicker baskets.
Like a lunchbox?
Kind of. These were often carried by Jews to keep their food ceremonially pure from Gentile influence. But here, in Gentile territory, the text uses the word spirus.
And what is a spirus?
A spirus is a large, flexible rope hamper distinctly associated with non-Jewish culture. It's a secular Gentile basket.
Oh, wow.
Matthew is using cultural signifiers to scream to the reader that this miraculous provision is happening specifically for the outsiders. Jesus is intentionally replicating his miracles for the Gentiles.
Proving his role as the savior of the entire world, not just the religious insiders.
Exactly.
That is a phenomenal detail. And when you think about the implications of that, it explains the escalating tension.
It makes total sense.
Right. If you are a Pharisee, your entire power base relies on your status as the exclusive broker of God's favor. You control the rituals, therefore, you control who gets access to God.
You're the middleman.
Yeah. But if God's favor, if these massive miracles and profound teachings are suddenly available to the Tyrians and the Canaanites and the Gentiles out in their own territory using their own rope hampers.
The Pharisees are out of a job.
Literally.
Their exclusivity is fundamentally worthless if the borders they police no longer exist. This inclusive ministry actively threatens the religious elites on an existential level. They are watching their monopoly on divine favor vanish in real time.
Which makes perfect sense of the stark prophetic warning Jesus delivers in this chapter about the fate of that elite establishment. He says that every plan that the Heavenly Father has not planted will be uprooted.
Uprooted, that's a strong word.
And the prep document emphasizes that this is not just a polite metaphor about bad ideas fading away over time.
No, that word uprooted carries severe historical weight. If we look at the historical timeline the source provides, this is a prophetic foreshadowing of a literal physical collapse.
A total destruction.
Yeah, the document notes that this warns of the eventual total collapse of the Pharisees' institutional power, which culminates in the destruction of the Second Temple.
The very center of their power.
The heart of it all.
The physical building they used to enforce their tradition of the elders would be completely dismantled.
The system simply could not sustain itself once the foundation of its exclusivity was removed.
So what does this all mean? If we trace the causal chain of this single chapter, the journey is staggering. We started with a corrupt system.
An entrenched system.
Right, an official delegation marching out from the Capitol to enforce an elaborate extra-biblical caste system just to protect their own political power. They tried to use hand-washing rituals to keep the population subjugated.
And it backfired spectacularly.
Jesus responds by exposing their regulatory authority as fraudulent, stripping away their legitimacy in front of the crowds. And because that makes him a target, he crosses enemy lines into deeply hostile territory.
He abandons the decaying system to build something entirely new.
He engages with a Canaanite woman, a historical blood enemy, proving that raw, persistent faith shatters centuries of cultural borders.
It's beautiful, really.
It is. And then he scales that up feeding 4,000 Gentiles, using their own cultural baskets, to declare that the mission is no longer confined to the insiders. It is a radical, border-shattering expansion that inevitably dooms the old establishment to be uprooted.
It's a brilliant historical progression. And, you know, if we look beyond just the historical facts to the underlying mechanics of what happened here, there is a fascinating leap in logic we have to consider.
Oh, definitely.
We've spent this entire deep dive talking about physical borders, Galilee, Jerusalem, Tyre, Sidon, and the visible religious borders of ancient purity laws. But it makes you wonder.
Wonder what?
Well, if a first century movement could shatter those deeply entrenched visible lines so easily through simple faith, what invisible ideological borders are we building today that are completely obsolete without us even realizing it?
Oh, that's heavy.
We often think we are so much more advanced than the Pharisees. Yet how many of our modern social, cultural, or professional systems are just new versions of the tradition of the elders? Like rigid, man-made rules designed to keep a few people in power while keeping everyone else out.
That is an incredible thought to leave on. We are so busy policing our own modern borders that we might not even realize when the system is about to be uprooted entirely. Listen, we thought we were just reading a quiet ancient text today, but instead we found ourselves analyzing the collapse of a geopolitical power structure.
It's been a wild ride.
It really has. Now, we want to hear from you. Drop a comment below with your thoughts on today's historical drama. When you look at the factions we discussed, you know, the rigid establishment and the border-shattering outsiders, who do you think the modern-day equivalents might be? Let us know your take. And hey, if you enjoyed this deep dive into the hidden political tension of historical texts, make sure you hit that like button and subscribe to the show so you never miss an exploration.
Yes, please do.
Also, be sure to check the description below for exclusive links and resources related to today's topic. You are not going to want to miss our next deep dive. We are teasing it right now. It is an even more intense historical confrontation that honestly makes today's clash with the delegation look like a warm-up. Until then, keep questioning the systems around you.